Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Rachel in Pam Shriver's hometown and Francis Tiafoe's home state, Baltimore, Maryland, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, introduced brilliantly there by Rachel in Baltimore, Maryland. Maryland. Home, of course, as she points out, to Pam Shriver. Hello, Pam, and Francis Tiafoe, and lots of other celebrities. Can anybody name one? I feel like Baltimore is a celeb hub.
All I remember from Baltimore is that it featured as the hometown of the person in Sleepless in Seattle, the Tom Hanks character, because he lived in Baltimore and she lived in Seattle. And apparently they were very far away from one another.
Setting of The Wire as well. I once spent some time on the tarmac at Baltimore Airport. Very much unexpectedly and unwelcomely, but that wasn't Baltimore's fault. It just wasn't my destination or my starting point at that moment in time. Hello, David. Hello, Matt. How are you?
All right. Yes, very well. Thank you.
Likewise. Yes, very well.
Tennis is happening. It is on the screen behind me here. Carlos Alcaraz is just jogging his way to the net for a coin toss with Dan Evans. So it's a replay of their very, very fun match at the US Open. Don't know whether to expect similar fun today. We'll be able to update you on it over the course of the podcast. We have had some results at normal times. We had a final played on a Sunday. What a novelty. But of course, Shanghai it's all over the place. I do not know what round we're in, but whatever tennis has happened, we'll be covering it for you on this Tennis Podcast. And just before we do all of that, a reminder to you that if you're a friend of the pod, you can enter a prize draw to be in with the chance of winning. And this is an incredible prize package. Semi-final tickets to the Billie Jean King Cup by Gamebridge Finals in Seville on Saturday, the 11th of November. The winner gets a pair of tickets for both sessions on that Saturday. You get two nights accommodation and return flights from any EU or UK airport. Devastating to have to say EU or UK. You have until Thursday, the 12th of October at 11:59 p.m. UK time to enter. The link to do so for friends will be in our newsletter this week. And if you're a friend who doesn't get the newsletter, what are you playing at, for starters? But don't worry, you can rectify that terrible situation by writing to us, friends@tennispodcast.net, and we'll send you the link. If you want to buy tickets to the Billie Jean King Cup Finals, the link to do so is also in our show notes. And Matt is going to be at the Billie Jean King Cup by Gamebridge Finals. So you'll also be winning the possible chance of seeing Matt.
I'm very excited to find out what Seville's like, Matt. Have you ever been there before? Because I'm really interested in to know what that's like as a city.
I have never been to Seville, no. It's probably the one major Spanish city I haven't been to, actually. So I'm very excited to go there. It's beautiful, I believe. And hopefully there'll be a bit of time to explore the city. It's a great venue, I think, kind of like with Malaga for the Davis Cup finals as well. The weather should be great in November still, you know, sort of mid-20s, I think. So good for any travelling fans. It'd be a nice place to be, I just think, at that time of year.
It's a tough job Matt's got, but
someone's got to do it.
Someone's simply got to complete Spain.
And what a hero.
It's going to be Matt Roberts. What a hero he is. Let's head to Beijing, shall we, which had its final yesterday, won by Iga Świątek. She beat Lyudmila Samsonova, the inexplicable Lyudmila Samsonova, 6-2, 6-2, to win that title, ending Coco Gauff's winning streak en route in the semi-final, 6-2, 6-3. She survived a big battle with Caroline Garcia in the quarterfinals. We'll get onto the Samsonova side of the draw and her route through to the final in a minute. But let's start with Świątek, for whom I thought it was a real return to form this week. And I don't mean her recent world number one form. I almost mean her form quite a bit before that, the form that got her to world number one. I felt a lot less anxious watching her this week. I felt like there was a freedom in her demeanour and in her play, which I haven't seen for quite a long time, actually. Am I just imagining that, David? Because am I overlaying the fact that I know she's not world number one anymore and she's relieved of that pressure of being the hunted rather than the hunter? Am I sort of overlaying my own narrative on it, or is there something there?
I think it is possible to overlay a little of how one feels watching somebody who's no longer world number one, who then becomes the chasing part of the chasing pack again, and assuming that that is creating freedom in the player's mind and demeanour. I think that I did that a little bit, but I also think there is something absolutely there in her demeanour. There's an energy. There is a freshness. She seemed revitalised a little. And without the weight of the world on her, I did note on Match Point she was emotional and then she was ecstatic. It was kind of, oh, goodness me, and then overwhelmed a little. And then suddenly the joy came out and she bounced around. But generally her play did have a freedom to it. And because she's such an interesting player because of how she's evolved from being this player full of variety that people reference when she first came on the tour to suddenly becoming this killer in rallies who just wants to take over. And she was playing big hitters in this tournament and highly ranked players, and she was standing up to the test time after time. And I did enjoy watching her. I do think there was less stress watching her because I think you know for her that she's not defending now, and it is a different mentality, and I think it has just given her something, a new look, a new vantage point to have a go at, and blimey, she came through with flying colours.
It's very refreshing, Matt, isn't it, to see players looking fresh during this portion of the season, because it's... Let's face it, it's a time of the year that is so defined by players looking various degrees of jaded and having various degrees of motivation, quite frankly. And it's always interesting, quite often you'll see players that have had an injury layoff at some point in the season looking really motivated and refreshed and hungry because, you know, their canister is less depleted than others. And obviously for Świątek, she's got... The season has a completely different complexion on it for her to what everything that came before it has. And I really enjoyed that this week, seeing her look so hungry and fresh because, you know, full disclosure, I find this time of the season hard. I'm looking for reasons to really care and I'm looking for reasons to watch other than the fact that I make a tennis podcast. And that sounds awful, doesn't it? I mean, I really do love the sport, but sometimes the lack of vibes it gets to me. So I thank Iga Świątek this week for injecting some zing to it all.
Yeah, that's a great word for it. Zing is very much what Iga Świątek had on the court this year, well, this week in Beijing. And I remember the night she lost to Ostapenko at the US Open, and we knew she would be losing her world number one ranking. We had a debate on the podcast. What way is this going to go for Iga Świątek now? Is losing number one, which has, you know, meant a lot to her, and she's carried that role so well for, I think, over 70 weeks she held that ranking. Is that going to be a big downer for her? Is she going to really struggle to find motivation again? Or is it going to completely free her up and make her go again? And I think, in her words, she's kind of been through the process of both of those things already. She said she was really down about losing the number one ranking, and perhaps that contributed to her bad performance the other week when she lost to Kudermatova. She still said she was not in a great place. She was still sort of coming to terms with being number two again. But it seems like through Beijing, she really found the motivation of, okay, I'm number two. That means there's things that I can work on, things that I can get better at. And there was a freshness that had sort of been missing, I would say, for quite a while to her game. And just as David said, the fact that it wasn't just that she was winning these matches, it was the way she was winning, I think, was so impressive. You know, there was lots of great tennis in matches you would absolutely expect her to win against, you know, Magda Linette and Varvara Krejčíková. Like, we know that Iga Świątek can go out there and blitz those opponents and be brilliant. But it was the matches, the final three that she played against Caroline Garcia, Coco Gauff and Ludmila Samsonova, I just thought were just signs that Świątek was kind of back to her best this week. Because Garcia, it was such a high quality match, probably the best match, well, definitely the best match I've watched since the US Open, for sure. They were both playing really, really well. Great to see Garcia playing well again. And I've often watched Świątek in these matches against big hitters recently and just been struck by how many unforced errors Iga Świątek will make. Like she's trying to take the big hitters on at their own game, and suddenly it can just sort of all run away from her. And I'm always been a bit curious. I'm like, you've got more in your game than that. You don't need to be necessarily trying to out-hit these players all the time. And against Garcia, she had that totally under control, even though she really had to battle to win. And then in the final against Samsonova, full disclosure, I was cursing the Buffalo Bills at the time. I didn't watch this match live. Had to go back and watch it this morning. But David sent through the stats, and it had a big fat zero next to Iga Świątek's unforced error count. And honestly, I thought that just has to be some kind of terrible mistake. You know, you can't go through two sets playing the way Iga Świątek so often does and not hit a single unforced error. So I watched it this morning with, you know, sort of whizzing through it, and I made a sort of count myself. And if I was being really harsh, I would say there was maybe a couple that I personally would have put down as unforced errors. That obviously is quite a subjective stat, really, isn't it? You know, where's an unforced error and where's an error? But generally, absolutely, it was so noticeable how Świątek had changed tactics against the big hitters this week and decided that, no, she doesn't need to try and out-hit them. She can rally with them. She can force them to make the errors. And that was just really refreshing to see. Almost like a clear-mindedness has come over her and her game. And maybe that's tied in with what we're talking about in terms of her now being number two rather than number one, and just having something to prove again and having to find new ways to win. Yeah, I think it's all related. And then the other win, obviously, against Coco Gauff in the semifinals, just felt like a reversion to the first seven Gauff-Świątek matches that we became so used to seeing. And of course, it all changed before the US Open when Gauff got that win. But Świątek reminded everyone, I think, why she's dominated that rivalry in the past, and she was brilliant in that match as well. So just a really good week for Iga Świątek, and great to see, because, yeah, it's not been a bad year at all for Iga Świątek. It's been an amazing year. You know, I think she's won five titles in a season back-to-back now, two years in a row. First player to do that since Serena about 9 or 10 years ago. So it's, you know, it's been consistently very good. It's just the experience of watching her sometimes hasn't always been quite so sort of easy as it always used to be. And I think this week I just felt calm watching her, like she had it all under control, and it was great to see.
I feel like a bit of a theme of this week's pod is going to be matchups and head-to-heads. And just before we get into the Samsonova side of things, just on what you said there about Świątek and Goff, that matchup being a reversion to their previous head-to-heads, do we expect that to continue? Is Cincinnati going to end up being the anomaly, and maybe they'll be the odd other anomaly throughout their careers? Or do you think, you know, next time it could... Do you expect the relay, the baton to be passed back and forth? What do we think, David? Or Matt? Anyone?
Well, I don't expect it to be passed back and forth unless Coco Gauff can make some quite big improvements, or Świątek's level generally to drop, because I think matchup-wise, I don't think it was an accident. I don't think seven matches, 14 sets in a row was any sort of accident. And I don't think Coco Gauff winning the US Open and having that excellent run changes that in a really material way. I don't know what you think, Matt, but I just feel like there is a reason for it. They don't match up well from a Coco Gauff perspective. I think she did a very good job to win that one. She did win, but there's not really anywhere to hide with that forehand unless you're able to loft it and so forth. And it is bizarre to think that Świątek got hammered by Ostapenko the way she did, and then Gauff just completely diffused and messed up the game of Ostapenko the next round. And who knows what would have happened had they met, but matchup-wise, it just feels like one of those to me.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. I think I'd be a bit surprised if it, you know, if the next seven were all straight sets win Frigga Świątek, like we saw at the start of their rivalry. I do think, as David said, they'll have some closer matches, but I do see Świątek sort of dominating overall. And yeah, I mean, Coco Gauff winning the US Open was not about her suddenly finding a level that was the same level as peak Iga Świątek. You know, it was about her toughing through a lot of three-set matches, and she did that this week as well until she got to Świątek. And it was about hiding weaknesses when she could and accentuating her strengths. And the matchup with Świątek just doesn't allow her to do that in quite the same way. And you know, so I think absolutely, I think Iga Świątek still feels very comfortable in that matchup with Coco Gauff, despite the one win that Gauff had. And it's, I don't think I'm ever going to look at it in quite the same way that I used to, now that at least Gauff has got a win. Like, we know it's possible. I won't be dreading that matchup. Like, I was excited for it this week and I will be again, but I think it was a reminder this week that no, it's, what is it now? 8-1 to Iga Świątek. Just because Coco Gauff had won the most recent one before this, the dominance really is with Świątek in that matchup.
Samsonova beat Rybakina in the semis, Rybakina having beaten Sabalenka in the quarters. That is four straight wins for Samsonova over Rybakina. Why does Rybakina have a Samsonova problem? I mean, why is Samsonova? Why anything Samsonova? But specifically here, why does Rybakina have a Samsonova problem?
I was really surprised by that head-to-head. I was watching that match and it kind of was referenced mid-match. I didn't actually know about the lopsidedness of that head-to-head until the commentator mentioned it. And I thought, I actually went and looked it up because I couldn't quite believe it, because I don't think of Rybakina having a problem with anybody. I kind of feel like her game can adapt to anyone, whether she can beat Świątek, we know she can beat Sabalenka, who she overcame in the round before that. And I just feel as though what's to go wrong with Rybakina's game really against anybody? And so it was quite jarring to see there were some competitive matches in there, but all four have gone the way of Samsonova, who I watch and never feel anything particularly strongly about. I'm never quite sure, well, what is it she's doing that is getting her to these positions? Truth is, she's absolutely hammering the living daylights out of the ball, but that's no great shakes in professional tennis. A lot of players can do that. I think the relentlessness of the way she does it, and the way she sort of goes through the court with pretty flat strikes, and she's not quite as hit and miss as Ostapenko, for instance. There's more consistency to her in that. And she was really hurting Rybakina with the drop shots. She must have hit 5 drop shots and completely bamboozled Rybakina, who, again, I don't think of as a poor mover. She just didn't seem to read them, didn't set off in time. The same shot wasn't working at all in the final for Samsonova. But honestly, I really am struggling to find out why Rybakina hasn't solved that conundrum yet, because I think she's that good, she should be. The only thing I can say is that I watched Rybakina against Andreeva a couple of rounds earlier, and she was 6-2, 4-2 down, and actually went... I saw that live score and made a note to go back and watch it. I watched it yesterday, and expecting Andreeva just to be playing this lights-out tennis, she wasn't really. She was playing within herself, and Rybakina was just hitting all over the place, just hitting long so many times. And then she managed to get her margins in and win the match. I don't actually feel that Rybakina played very well last week, but I can't give you the reasons for the lopsidedness of that rivalry, because like you, I don't really understand Samsonova. I don't really understand how she's doing what she's doing. She should have lost to Marta Kostyuk 2 rounds earlier. She was a double breakdown in the final set, and I was working while that match was on, and that seemed so unlikely that she would come back. And I feel like I'm probably not giving her credit by the way I'm describing her, but I don't really get her either.
Yeah, there's this weird sort of rock, paper, scissors thing going on with the fact that Samsonova beats Rybakina, Rybakina beats Świątek, and Świątek beats Samsonova. And as you said, it's just the beauty of tennis matchups, really. I was struck watching Rybakina Samsonova by the number of times that Samsonova was rushing Rybakina off the serve. Like, Rybakina would hit quite a good serve and Samsonova would just be on it immediately and just sort of be immediately putting Rybakina on the back foot. You rarely see Rybakina on the back foot, but, you know, the sort of breakdown of winners' unforced errors in that match was Samsonova had way more winners and way more unforced errors, which, you know, you can probably read too much into those stats sometimes, but I think it did just say that Samsonova was the one dictating. And normally in a Rybakina match, she's the one dictating, and for some reason, she just doesn't seem to be able to do it against Samsonova. It really is fascinating. And yeah, just it's almost like they all need to sort of talk to each other and say, how do you... I'll tell you how to beat her if you can just give me the codes how to beat her. But of course, like, they're not going to do that.
The results this week in Beijing mean that the Cancun WTA finals lineup is set. Vondrosheva and Mukova have qualified. Maria Sakkari is first alternate. I do wonder if Sakkari, whether from the start or whether coming in midway through, will end up playing, because I am not sure if Vondrosheva is fit with that knee. Maybe she'll give it a go because it's... You know, it's such a big deal for her to qualify for Cancun and all the rest of it. But I'd be surprised, put it that way, if we don't end up seeing some of Maria Sakkari. But the top eight is Świątek, Sabalenka, Rybakina, Goff, Pegula, Jabeur, Vondrosheva, Mukova.
It's a great lineup, isn't it? We've got all the...
It is a great lineup.
Like, everyone there apart from Pegula, I think, has reached the Grand Slam final this year.
It's a great lineup. I am pumped. I am pumped for the WTA finals.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or on your smart TV in HD.
Sounds great. There's genuinely nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere.
And can I just sit and watch court Susan Longland all day?
You sure can, David. Wherever the stories are, the rivalries emerge and the generations clash, you can watch it all with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Be there when it happens by subscribing to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TennisPod20 for 20% off your annual subscription. On to the ATP event in Beijing, which of course finished days ago. Anyway, see everything we said last week about the discombobulated nature of tennis at the moment. But it was won by Jannik Sinner, 7-6, 6-1 over Carlos Alcaraz in the semifinals, and then 7-6, 7-6 over Daniil Medvedev in the final, thus proving everything we've said up to this point of the podcast about matchups being everything in tennis to be utter trash, because up until whenever it was, Wednesday, I thought Jannik Sinner had an incurable Daniil Medvedev problem, and it turns out he doesn't, or he never did, or he did and he has cured it. Which of those is it, David?
Well, I would think that Iga Świątek might say, well, it's just the one. You've got the one that you're going to win for a bit, and then I'm going to go and win the rest of them. And Daniil Medvedev probably thinking that as well. But I don't know. I found it quite interesting that Sinner, after he beat Alcaraz, who has an interesting head-to-head against as well, because he has the better of that rivalry at the moment. I mean, he had it put to him, you know, you've lost 6 out of 6 against Medvedev, and he said, well, there are a couple of things I'm going to try. Now, I asked Matt, could you identify what those things were? Because I didn't get to watch that match as it went out. And, I mean, Matt couldn't really put a finger on exactly what it was. I mean, he just seemed to be playing really well, and he was going lights out. I mean, and if you consider that Sinner, what he was being sick in a bin in one match, and then in another match against Dan Evans, he was hobbling around with cramp, and Evans was mimicking him because he didn't like the way he was doing it, and then hitting absolutely blistering winners seconds later. He went for it, and he's playing bloody well, and I think he shouldn't have a problem playing against Daniil Medvedev. I don't think he should be winning them all, but I don't think he should be losing them all either. He should be able to win some of them, and so to me, this is a correction that should happen. I am interested to see future matches for them, but I do think it's quite a big deal for Sinner. This quite a breakthrough.
Interesting, David, that you think it's such a breakthrough, because this is not the biggest title of his career. It's not the biggest title of his season. He's won a 1,000 this season. Other than Medvedev, you know, he's beaten Alcaraz before. You know, for most players, beating Alcaraz is an enormous deal. It would be a big coming of age. But for Sinner, it's kind of like, yeah, mate, you've really got a rivalry going with the famous Carlos Alcaraz. So why, and add into that the fact that we quite often put an asterisk next to results at this point of the season, just in terms of what they mean for the future. Why do you see this as such a big deal? Because it's not new stuff for Sinner.
Well, because I think his main problem has been in his own head, and winning the biggest matches on a big showcase stage where all eyes are on him and his opponent and nobody else. And that we've been talking about the struggles with some of the crowds, and there have been some poor crowds in some matches. And we got an email from tournament director Lars Graf, a listener of ours, who heard that and sent us a picture of the absolutely packed house for Alcaraz against Sinner and the one in the final. I think that him winning that match in an occasion like that, where it's absolutely packed, and Alcaraz is going to want to be winning, Medvedev we know is going to be wanting to win, and Sinner has taken it from them, is quite a big moment. I take the point, end of year stuff, and I can't guarantee that this will be a difference maker. It just feels like something different to me because he's beaten them back to back. Djokovic aside, they're the two best players in the world, and he's done it in front of a full house where I think I would have probably expected him to lose both matches, and he's just gone and wrestled it away from them both. And they're both straight sets. I think it's quite a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely take all of the caveats about this time of year, and really trying to find meaning in this time of year is, you know, is a fool's game, probably, really. But I was watching those Jannik Sinner matches this week with my jaw wide open. I thought he was phenomenally good against both Alcaraz and Medvedev. And it was very difficult for me to then say, oh, well, it's October tennis. He just seemed so good. And there did seem as David's saying, almost a calmness to him, because I do think that Medvedev lopsided head-to-head has been a lot about Sinner being in his own head in that matchup. That matchup to me is not a Świątek-Goff situation. That is a match that Jannik Sinner probably should be winning a lot of the time, and he stepped up in the big moments against Medvedev, played two phenomenal tie breaks, absolutely stunning. And having the record against Carlos Alcaraz that he's got is such a feather in his cap compared to everyone else. Like, I think it's easier for Jannik Sinner to improve his head-to-head against all the other players. You know, he's got losing head-to-head against Tsitsipas, Rune, Zverev, Medvedev. You know, I think it's easier for him to correct that than it is for a lot of players to be able to figure out what on earth they have to do against Carlos Alcaraz. He's done the hard thing, I think, already, in that he matches up well with Alcaraz, and he can make Alcaraz malfunction a bit by the way he rushes him, and he can just turn it into a total... almost just feels like a hitting contest from the baseline, and Alcaraz isn't able to use all of his...
turns into a slugfest, doesn't he?
Yeah, and Alcaraz isn't able to use his incredible speed and his incredible variety. It's just sort of back and forth hitting, and Sinner is phenomenally good at that. And I think the more he grows, the better he gets, the more he goes deep in tournaments, I think he will figure out his head-to-head against the other players that I've just mentioned there. But I don't think a lot of those players will be able to figure out Carlos Alcaraz. So I think long term, it's great for Sinner that he's able to cope with Alcaraz. And, you know, the emphasis now is, and it's not like he dominates that head to head, it's close, but the emphasis now is on Alcaraz to try and figure out Sinner. And I just think that's really, really interesting. And there was little stuff he did, like coming forward a little bit more against Medvedev. Like, it wasn't all the time, and I still don't think it's a natural part of his game, but there were little signs of it, which I thought he did really well. Yeah, he was just brilliant this week. And I think what David said, doing it back-to-back, successive matches, you know, that Medvedev and Alcaraz was as tough as it got in that tournament, and he beat them in consecutive days. It was just really impressive. And, yeah, tough to make big, sweeping assessments, as we always say at this time of year, but it does feel like something's improved and changed with Jannik Sinner this week. I was really impressed.
Yeah, those were really good points. And I guess the fact that he has done it before, won bigger titles than this, makes it easier to not put the asterisk next to this result because of the timing in the season. You know, when Félix Auger-Aliassime went on his tear at this time in the season last year, well, that's the anomaly at the moment in his career, isn't it? Him doing that then, yes, he broke his title dark and he was unreal, but it was all indoor. It was all at a certain level of tournament at a certain time of the year when everybody else is running on fumes. That is the ultimate kind of asterisky set of results. He may very well yet go on to carry that form into elsewhere, produce it elsewhere, but at the moment that kind of stands alone. But for Sinner, this adds to the feathers already in his cap, and I agree, I was so impressed. And I guess I've been a little bit less high on Jannik Sinner than some other people, just because I feel a bit scarred by certain performances. I was there for his performance against Medvedev in the Miami final, and I was a bit scarred by that. I was scarred by his performance against Djokovic at Wimbledon, and those performances really stick in my mind and make me think, God, how can a player as good as you sort of play, look that impotent, I suppose. But he certainly didn't look that this week. I was so impressed. And I agree, I feel it could be a big result. Although apparently, maybe anyone can beat Carlos Alcaraz. Dan Evans currently 3-1. First set.
Four down.
Maybe Alcaraz is just there for the taking. Well, let's just look. I haven't been watching the match, David, because I've been recording a podcast, but I'm willing to bet that Evans hasn't made this a slugfest.
No, you're right, he hasn't. No, it's all been guile and get in.
Lovely. What a great new slogan for Dan Evans' style of play. Incidentally, Jannik Sinner's win in Beijing means he has achieved his goal for the year. He's qualified for Turin. And that's great news for that event, which when it launched in that part of the world, I think everybody just assumed that it would have Berrettini and Sinner kind of every year, pretty much, that Italian representation would be a given. And it didn't have it last year, and it was a great event, but it missed it, I think. And specifically, Turin Jannik Sinner, we've seen that guy, and that was my favourite Jannik Sinner when he came in as alternate a couple of years ago. Like, he turned into a hype man. It was like Kyle Edmund at Laver Cup. So I am excited to see ATP Finals Jannik Sinner in Italy again. I think that's great news for everybody. Congratulations, Jannik, on achieving your 2023 goal. Just before we get into a status update on Shanghai, another result to wrap up that we should have done last week, I think, but I'm actually,
no,
as much as it wasn't
hadn't
planned.
Finished.
No, it hadn't finished? Oh, great. Of course not.
Of course.
Sorry. Astana was won by Adrian Mannarino. He beat Sebastian Korda in the final. And in lieu of finding anything to say about Adrian Mannarino, I just want to point everybody in the direction of Gary Nathan's piece this week in Racquet Magazine about Adrian Mannarino. And I just love the fact that there's somebody out there writing whole articles about Adrian Mannarino. And it's definitive, and it's called "What is Adrian Mannarino doing?"
What is
and
he
it's,
doing?
It's fantastic.
Which is basically what Francis Tiafoe said about him at the US Open, wasn't it? When they played that, I think it was four-set match, and he was like, "What is this guy doing on the court?" And I should say, I do remember a few weeks ago when Mannarino, who is having an incredible year, you know, he's won a few titles, and to be doing what he's doing, he seems to be getting better, which is pretty impressive, really.
He's having the best season of his career at 35.
Yeah, which is incredibly, incredibly impressive. And he ties players up in knots. I mean, I actually watched him this morning get absolutely blown away by Andrei Rublev in Shanghai. Rublev apologised to him at the net for saying, "I'm sorry, I played so well," which was a very Andrei Rublev thing to do. But we got a lot of emails. I mean, we do often get a lot of emails, but we got a lot of emails from Adrian Mannarino fans and defenders. They are out there. There's a lot of people out there who appreciate.
Look, my
the
dad's
style
got a
of
lot of
game.
Burner accounts, Matt.
Cameraman Matthew is a big Mannarino fan. Like, yeah, he's quirky.
It is.
I'm pleased that there are players who can sort of thrive playing in that weird game style that he does. And Gary Nathan's piece points out that he adapted his game because of an injury. And, you know, when he was much younger, that's why he plays with the sort of really condensed strokes that he does. I didn't know that until reading that piece. And yeah, he's probably not for everyone, but he is for some people.
Yeah, he must be the inspo for Corentin Moutet, who's trying to totally adapt his whole game as a result of injury. Corentin Moutet is trying to transition to only underarm serving. I don't know if you're aware of that, David.
I have
that's
heard that.
Something that's happening.
I'm intrigued. I've had my Maxime Cressy year of following somebody who only wants to serve and volley. So now this is the next installment. And that, let's be honest, hasn't gone especially well. So let's see how Corentin gets on.
Do you remember when Maxime Cressy hit a double foot fault?
Yes. Wasn't that against Runa at the Australian Open this year?
It was.
Very funny.
That
it
wasn't
was.
The same tournament in which he told us he was going to be world number one, was it?
It was 12 months later.
It was a year
later.
On. Okay. Mm. He celebrated that anniversary with a double foot fault.
Okay.
So Sebastian Korda reaches the final in Astana, only to be Manorino'd. It happens to the best of us. And then beats Daniil Medvedev in Shanghai, 7-6, 6-2. So back to the theme of the week. Does Medvedev have a Sebastian Korda problem? And David, I'll defer to you on this because you are the guy that saw that Korda was going to beat Medvedev at the Australian Open this year about a point and a half into the match. So you obviously saw something. I mean, you obviously saw that Korda was playing really well, and he does have very seductive stroke production when he's on, doesn't he? It looks lovely. But you obviously saw something in that matchup. I'm guessing that you're continuing to see that.
Well, that is what it is, Catherine. I think it's when Korda is on, and he can look two very different players when he's on and when he's not. Some players don't look that different when they're on their absolute best form. Like, I can't really tell the difference between Andrei Rublev playing the best match of his life and playing a normal match. I think that they both look more or less the same. You know, I really
David
am struggling.
Is not a Rublev guy. Is
I like the man. I don't want to go watch him really. And that's just me. That I'm not trying to be mean or unkind or anything. I'm just not into watching Andrei Rublev matches particularly. Despite the fact that I think he's a great fella.
I spent a year watching Maxime Cressy double foot fault, but he won't watch Andrei Rublev for love nor money.
I did give up my experiment quite quickly, I have to be honest with you, of watching every Maxime Cressy match. But anyway, with Korda, I think you see somebody so balanced and capable of hitting both forehand and backhand with such intent and destructive poise. He's got aggression and ferocity and poise all at the same time when he's really playing well. And I sometimes think, well, how would you get the ball past him? And he was kind of doing to Medvedev what Medvedev does to everybody else, but he was doing it with aggression and just turning his power back on himself. And with instantly I thought, well, how does Medvedev beat this guy if this guy carries on playing like this? The truth is, quite a lot of the time Korda doesn't play like that. And he'll have injuries and setbacks. But he'll also sometimes really lose his form and start to look really quite unstable. And so I can't get my head around why that happens as such. It doesn't feel like so much should be going wrong as it does. But yeah, I think when Korda plays well, I don't give Medvedev much chance.
Medvedev was unhappy with the speed of the court in Shanghai. Oh, we were back.
Bombshell.
We were back to that narrative again.
He did point out, look, I reached the India Wells final, and that was awful, court speed wise. He was sort of like, I can play on inferior courts, but
and then Taylor Fritz sort of came up with a correction to him on Twitter, and he said, no, it's not the court that's different this year, it's the balls, and that's why it's playing slower. It's very tennis player chat.
God, that's so Nadal, isn't it? It's the balls. Other interesting things that have happened in Shanghai so far, other than Dan Evans still being a breakup on Carlos Alcaraz.
In a 13-minute game.
And I can give you an update that Nicholas Jarry has just beaten Lorenzo Sonego. I can change channel now and put Alcaraz on.
You've also, Matt, quite high up in the Shanghai section of our agenda, put a Fabian Marajan update in. You've put
well,
he's
it
back.
Me.
As if everybody's been wondering where he's been.
Well, I am he's quite curious where he's been now.
He's beaten Artur Rinderknecht, Alex de Minaur, and Dusan Lajovic, and now plays Casper Ruud.
Mm. Fabian Marajan, of course, the guy who pops up and stunningly beat Carlos Alcaraz in Rome earlier this year, drop-shotting him off the court and just generally being great, and then has absolutely not backed that up since. I just found it amusing that he's winning again. And yeah, honestly, if the way he played against Alcaraz was incredible. Like if he brings that level, Ruud will have his hands full.
If
yes,
does not exist. Ben Shelton will play Jannik Sinner in round four. Yes, please. Shelton having beat Roman Sefiulin, who for a period of a few days there looked like the best player in the world. I mean, what a ball striker he is! It's such a gorgeous, clean hit. He's another curiosity, isn't he? He was a top junior, and has just really taken his time to transition to seniors. And he still doesn't seem to have been able to do it consistently. And sorry to make sort of Russian generalizations, but he's a bit Karatsev-like, isn't he? And that he occasionally pops up, looks just sumptuous, and then disappears for a bit. Fabian Marajan style.
Yeah, I mean, he was fantastic against Zverev the other day. I mean, I think Zverev's probably hit the wall. He's played so much tennis recently. But he was made to look ordinary against Sefiulin, who, as you say, has got a lovely ball strike, plus angles, drop shots, volleys. He was getting into the net a lot and winning. Well, it was 6-3, 6-1, I think, that match. And then he went a set up on Shelton, and I saw the results at the end and went back to try to find the breaks of serve that Shelton got against him in sets 2 and 3, because I was curious, well, how has he beaten this guy? Because Sefiulin looks so good. And part of it was Shelton suddenly igniting and just hitting him off the court and getting energized the way he does when he's really on it. And also Sefiulin just missing terribly. Suddenly went through a little spells of missing loads. And Shelton, in classic sort of Pete Sampras style, just getting the break and then holding. I was really impressed with Shelton.
First time he's won back-to-back matches not at a Grand Slam, I believe.
Amazing.
Ben Shelton.
And he's done that twice.
Yes.
Amazing results, really, Shelton at Slams.
Zheng Zhizhen has become the first Chinese player to reach the fourth round of Shanghai in the event's history. This coming off the back of him winning gold at the Asian Games. He's beaten Richard Gasquet, Thomas Martin Echeverry and Brandon Nakashima. Nakashima having just absolutely taken Holger Rune to the cleaners earlier in the week. Love and two. Or two and love for Nakashima over Rune, who just needs to stop and take a break. I just think that the decisions he's making are boneheaded at the moment, and it's worrying me about Holger Rune. Speaking vaguely of which, Stefanos Tsitsipas gave an interview to Tennis TV this week. Quote, "My dad is here to stay. I have no intention of ever pushing him away. Mark Philippoussis is not part of the team anymore. I wanted to try with a coach and see how that might work. It was a little bit off tune in many ways, and not having the presence of my dad there felt like I was sort of losing part of my identity as a tennis player. I wasn't able to adjust to the new form or ways of teaching or methods that were applied by Mark, who I admired and liked watching a lot on TV when I was younger." could I have a reaction to that, please, from someone?
I almost feel like there'll be casual listeners of the tennis podcast who've maybe missed a few episodes. And the last episode they listened to, it was Tsitsipas is all in on Mark Philippoussis. Like, it's happened this happened so quickly, this, which I is probably the thing that stands out to me the most. Like, I just think you've got to give coaching setups and partnerships more time than that. But what he's saying there is, you know, it's interesting insight, actually. I thought he was pretty open in that interview. But that's just it, isn't it? His identity as a tennis player is tied to his dad. And that is something that I don't think is ever going to change. He's laid that out there. And it's just a question of whether he can revert. The thing about Tsitsipas, it feels like he needs to go back to what he had. And I think that's such a hard thing to do. And I felt like Philippoussis...
I don't think he can now, because what he had was so linked to his youth and newness.
Right.
I don't think that's... But you can't go home again.
So bringing Philippoussis on board was a way of sort of maybe trying to push him out from that and sort of take him into the future and move on as a tennis player. And what he's saying there is sort of like it's just going to be hard for him to do that. It's pretty worrying, I think, that there doesn't seem to be room within that setup for another voice.
I feel sorry for Tsitsipas. I for him as a human being, go and figure out who you are. Like, take the tennis out of it. You need to figure out who you are without your dad there and your mum all the time. Who are you as a tennis player? Who are you as a person? And that's... I feel really sorry for him. I'm sure it is unbelievably hard. He shouldn't be the one having... Like, his parents should be the ones taking the lead, I think. But
it sounds like he doesn't want the change, really. I mean, it sounds like he wants to be what he was and be just with his dad. I mean, I wouldn't advise that, personally. And I thought Philippoussis was a good idea, and I still do, and I would have given that time. But in terms of trying to go back to what you were and getting the results you had in the past, well, that's what the setup was when he had those results. Personally, I don't think you can go back in time and just recreate because of your age and because your experiences and the scar tissue we often talk about, the newness, as you've referenced. But then I think Caroline Wozniacki kept trying little stints with coaches and always going back to her dad. And that overall, I think, worked for her. I don't personally think... I think we probably have seen the best of Stefanos Tsitsipas overall. Up to him to prove that wrong. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if he can. But it doesn't seem like he has the makeup to go in a different direction to this. I think that's what this experiment has probably proved. Maybe he'll change his mind again in 2 months' time. But it's not going very well at the moment.
Some other news from the tennis world this week. Tennis Australia announced, John McEnroe voice out of nowhere, that the Australian Open is becoming a 15-day event starting on Sunday. Just like the French Open, they've said, with data showing matches are now longer, the move to a Sunday start is designed to help alleviate the pressure on late-night finishes for both the players and the fans. We've listened to feedback from the players and the fans and are excited to deliver a solution to minimise late finishes while continuing to provide a fair and equitable schedule on the stadium courts. The additional day will achieve this, benefiting scheduling for fans and players alike. The first round will now be played over 3 days instead of two, also giving fans an extra day of unbelievable tennis, entertainment, food and family fun. Every year our team works hard to bring fans an event that feels new and exciting. The Sunday start increases the number of AO sessions in the three arenas from 47 to 52. The day session at Rod Laver Arena and Margaret Court Arena will feature a minimum of two matches, down from three, to limit the potential of late night finishes. Night sessions will continue to feature a minimum of 2 matches, and the John Cain Arena schedule also remains the same. My take on this is sort of fine. I see why it makes total sense to want to introduce an extra day full stop, but in particular an extra weekend day to your event to boost revenues, especially at a post-COVID time when there have been hard hits and there are losses to recoup. I kind of think fair enough. I don't like the pretense that this is for late night scheduling reasons, because I don't think it solves that problem really at all. I'd be very surprised if it does, and I don't think that's the real reason behind it. And I think the real reason behind it is fine, but I don't think it's scheduling. I think it's revenue.
Yeah, I think that's the main reason too. I think it helps the first 3 days, I think, when they can put it over more time. And I think maybe it'll take away the absolute extremes of the late night finishes. I don't think we would be as likely to get an Andy Murray 4 a.m. situation, just because I think that they will have a bit more space to play with. But generally speaking, with 2 matches in the evening session, if that evening session isn't starting earlier, I don't see that it'll bring things forward that much.
That's it. That's the point. If the evening session is still starting at 7 o'clock and you've still got 2 matches from 7, all you're doing with this new schedule is making it pretty much guaranteed that the night session will at least start on time, because you've only got 2 matches to get through before the start of the night session rather than 3. So that, you know, you should start your night session at 7 o'clock every time, no problem. But if you've then got 2 matches and one of them is a 5-setter that goes, you know, 5 hours, and you've then got a best-of-3-set match, you're still absolutely looking at finishing in the early morning. I'm fascinated to know whether they bring the start of the night session forward, because that to me would be a way of, trying to alleviate and take away some late night finishes. But otherwise, I don't see what changes really in terms of that late night session. But I agree, you know, an extra day of Grand Slam tennis, Roland Garros has shown that it works. I'm all in on that. I think that's great. But I need more information to be convinced about the night session stuff.
I also think an unintended consequence of this looks like it's going to be less women's tennis on the Rod Laver Arena, because I've gone back through the schedules, and generally speaking, with the 3-day session matches, it would be 2 women's and 1 men's, because 2 men's and 1 women's is sort of a guaranteed recipe for starting the night session late. It's going to be the extra women's match in the day session that gets the shove. Now, I expect it still to be equal in terms of match numbers on Rod Laver Arena. It'll be a men's and a women's in each session, but that doesn't mean equal in terms of time, because women's matches are shorter than men's. So, I just wanted to point that out. Tennis Australia also released their plans for the United Cup in January, which of course starts in December. It starts on December 29th and runs to January 7th. Ties will be reduced to 2 singles matches, 1 for women, 1 for men, and 1 mixed, rather than the 2 singles each for men and women. And the ties will take place over just 1 session rather than over 2 sessions or 2 days in some cases. Host cities have been reduced from 3 to 2, just Sydney and Perth. The idea is a shorter format, shorter event, better for players, better for fans, better for broadcast. And I think those all sound like good reforms, moving far more towards the Hopman Cup format. And that's good, I think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think I can't entirely remember what we said at the time, but I think that that's what was kind of bothering us about what is actually a really cool event, a cool format, men and women together. Those were the elements that were making it a bit long-winded and kind of unwieldy in a way that I think this should solve.
Yep, absolutely. So this week in tennis, there's more Shanghai, of course. Dan Evans held for 4-1. What's the score now, David?
I believe it's now been broken. Okay.
All that effort in the sort of 20-minute game.
Yes.
So more of that match, more of Shanghai. The WTA are in Zhengzhou for a 500 event. Caroline Garcia, Maria Sakkari, Ludmila Samsonova, Barbora Krejcikova, Donna Vekic, Daria Kazatkina, Veronika Kudermetova, all playing there. There's also WTA events in Seoul and Hong Kong. Seoul headlined by Pegula and Ostapenko. Hong Kong has Azarenka and Haddad Maia. And we'll be back next Monday to wrap up all of that for you, at which point I think tennis will be back on track in terms of schedule. All finals will have been played at the weekend. We'll be vaguely sync. Cannot wait. We have a mascot for this episode. You're trying to kill me with this, Matt, aren't you? We have Coco, the one-eyed wonder, owned by Heather and Jody. Coco was adopted with her brother Byron a little over a year ago. She was born with one eye, but that doesn't limit her joy of watching her namesake Coco Gauff slay on the tennis court. She's super cuddly and a little mischievous. She likes to sneak into her, wait for it, her dog sister Billie Jean's bed when no one is looking.
Oh.
I'd like a picture of that, please, Heather and Jody. I would like Coco and Billie Jean, the other Billie Jean, in bed together. But I'm looking at a picture of Coco the cat with Coco Gauff. Excellent photography work, Heather and Jody, by the way. And she's gorgeous. She's absolutely lovely. It does look like she's winking at me, which I imagine is how Heather and Jody feel all the time. But yes, thank you very much, Heather and Jody, and thank you to Coco. We have our mascots. David's got Maisie, I've got Xenia, and Xenia, we totally shot ourselves in the foot this week because we did win points with Iga Świątek, but in the process of predicting Iga Świątek, we also disclosed the fact that we didn't actually think Iga Świątek was going to win the tournament, and called into question the entire system of nominating predictions. So we've got the points.
It's a hollow victory.
The points, but not the dignity, Xenia. Matt has got Darwin, who neither dignity nor points. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Ilana Kloss. We have, of course, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. They're our top folks and executive producers. And Matt, we have shout outs.
We have Spencer Grider in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Whoa. Right, Spencer.
Hello, Spencer. Salt Lake City, home of the Olympics a while ago.
Yeah, and Utah, home of the Jazz basketball team that I used to watch in the 90s.
The Utah Jazz, yes.
And all I have for Spencer is Spencer Matthews, who was on our row at the British Podcast Awards, who we had to walk past to go and collect our award.
Who's he?
He had a lot of hair, didn't he?
I think you would call him a TV personality.
I believe he was originally from Made in Chelsea.
Okay.
Yeah.
David.
And I don't watch that.
Lots of other things.
All right, Spencer.
Great way of mentioning the Podcast Awards again, Matt.
Yeah, I'm going to try and do that every week, I think. Just think of a subtle way to keep bringing it up.
Thank you, Spencer.
We've also got Jacob Telfer, who is in London.
Right, Jacob.
Hello, Jacob. Telfer is a bit like Telford, which is near Shrewsbury, where we're going next week for our live show. Tickets available.
Very good.
Link in the show notes.
Splendid. I don't know any Jacob tennis players. This isn't going particularly well.
Well, Jacob has helped us out by saying he'd also like to give a shout out to his fiance and fellow friend of the pod, Ursula, like Ursula Radwanska.
Oh, very good.
Oh, very good.
Mm.
That's superb.
Thank you, Jacob. You've done us a solid there.
Hi, Ursula.
And hi, Ursula. Yeah. Thank you to you both.
And finally, we've got Catherine Leap Lazar, who is from the Washington, D.C. area, but currently living in Queens, New York.
Hi, Catherine.
All the tennis places and names.
Yes, this is
church,
different pew situation. And Catherine would like to give a shout out to her mum, Carolyn, who is also a friend and who celebrated her 60th birthday on October the 5th.
Aww. Happy birthday, Carolyn.
Love that. Happy birthday, Carolyn. Seeing as we're doing birthdays, could I also say happy birthday to Rosie?
Yes, you can. Happy birthday, Rosie.
She's 11 today, or 77 in dog years.
Bless.
Yes. Thank you, Catherine. Great name, obviously. Thank you, Carolyn. Hello to Carolyn. Happy birthday, Carolyn. And thank you to all of our shout-outs. If you'd like to get a shout-out, the link to do that is in our show notes by becoming a friend of the Tennis Podcast. There's also the competition to win tickets to the Billie Jean King Cup Finals. That is open to friends of the Tennis Podcast by subscribing to the Friends newsletter, which, of course, you've done that, haven't you? Why wouldn't you have done that? If you'd like to subscribe to the regular newsletter, the link to do that is in our show notes. Matt does great work every week, and I highly recommend it. Tell your friends, leave us an Apple Podcast review, and listen to us next week when we'll be back with more tennis chat. We'll speak to you then.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.